Today at Reader's Corner, novelist Jonathan Evason, author of The Revised Fundamentals of Caregiving. I'm Bob Custra. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Jonathan Evason's novel, The Revised Fundamentals of Caregiving, is an engaging read that will definitely make you laugh. But it's not a lightweight book by any means. Family, friendship, loss, and disability are just some of the big themes it explores. In the book, Mr. Evason takes us on a journey, both literal and figurative, that brings together a former stay-at-home dad who has lost everything and a wheelchair-bound teenager he's caring for. Not far into the novel, they head out on a road trip, pick up a few unlikely friends along the way, and confront situations that challenge what it means to care for another person. Today we're featuring an encore edition of our interview with Jonathan Evason. When we spoke last, a movie version of The Revised Fundamentals of Caregiving, starring Paul Rudd, was in production. It has since been released, and you can now find it on Netflix. Mr. Evason's latest novel, titled This Is Your Life, Harriet Chance, was also published shortly after our interview aired. Jonathan Evason will be visiting Boise later this month as a featured presenter at Storyfort, the literary and story-centric festival that is part of the annual music fest, Treefort. Storyfort is free and open to the public, and you can find out more online at www.treefortmusicfest.com. Mr. Evason joins us by phone from Bainbridge Island, Washington, for this interview. Jonathan Evason, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Oh, keep going, Bob. I was enjoying
this. So, I absolutely loved your book. It's one of those books where I thought, when I got to the end, can't they just turn that van around and go someplace else? I don't want this to end. And unfortunately, of course, all good things come to an end. There's so many things I could say about this, but you're the guy that's supposed to be answering the question, so I don't want to monopolize this. But among other things that impressed me about this book was the insight it gave me into people who live at the margins of society. You know, in my line of work, I run across middle-class students for the most part. I deal with faculty and staff. I live in a great city. I don't get to the margins of society very often, and I would suspect that a good number of our listeners don't get to the margins of society except to bump across somebody in Walmart or to bump across somebody in a parking lot or the doctor's office or wherever it is. We just don't get there. Your novel takes us there. Would you help us understand how you, I assume, a middle-class guy, and you can talk a little bit about your background because you certainly had an unusual and tragic aspect to your growing up, how you get inside people's heads that way, how you can so accurately depict what somebody's going to say in dialogue that you're picking up on the roadside of an interstate?
Well, I mean, first of all, I was kind of raised on the margins a little bit. I mean, I'm a working-class kid, raised by a single mom. And you know, as you know, Bainbridge is kind of a wealthy community, but we didn't have any money. My old man ran off when I was pretty young. I was raised mostly by my older sisters, one of whom died in a freak car accident, which is one of the inspirations for the book, actually, seeing what that did to my family, you know, and so that experience with grief, you know, definitely informed by my life. I've always been attracted to the margins. The only characters I really want to read about, I guess, are the ones that don't have enough of a voice in our culture, I guess.
So this obviously was a very personal project for you, as you alluded to. Tell us what happened in your family that really is the basis for your writing this book.
Well, part of it is, the first part of it is just Ben. You know, my first marriage blew up about 15 years ago. My life just really jumped the rails. My first wife had an affair with an old friend, and I just didn't see that one coming, and it just leveled me. So I was kind of in a place where Ben was. I was at the time 35-year-old author of 8 unpublished books. I wasn't much of a breadwinner, probably when my wife got restless in the first place. And what happened was, since I didn't see it coming, I was leveled. I went through about a 2-year period there where everything was just a blur. I don't remember hardly anything. I met people all the time. I don't remember. It was the one time in my life I really stopped drinking because I love to drink, but like I knew better to not tempt Bacchus under those circumstances. And the thing that really kind of brought me back to humanity, I think, was getting a job in caregiving. I didn't really have many possibilities. You know, I'd been a landscaper. I'd sold some used cars in Montana. I'd telemarketed sunglasses, sorted rotten tomatoes, just about every lousy job you could ever think of. And I ended up taking the same 29-hour night course that Ben took and got into caregiving, you know, mostly because I was broke. And the experience really changed my life. I mean, I learned at that point when you feel like you really don't have anything left to give, that's when you give. So the young man I started caring for, whom the book's dedicated to, Case Levinson, just turned 30 in February, which is amazing, because when I started working with him 12 years ago, he was pretty much at his life expectancy. But you know, drug therapy has gotten so much better over the last decade that he's leveled off, and they haven't figured out how to you know, produce dystrophin in the joints yet, but they're getting closer. There's a lot of promising things. The lifespan of these kids is going up every year, and so he was just happened to be born in a great window. So I'm happy to say he's still alive.
So tell us about that disease. It's Duchenne muscular dystrophy, is it?
Duchenne muscular dystrophy. There's a chemical the body produces in the joints called dystrophin. And in kids with this neuromuscular disease, they don't produce it. And so what happens is their joints kind of just, you know, tighten and tighten and tighten until they just don't move. And his body just would eventually just kind of fold in on itself. Like he jokingly, you know, he refers to himself as a human pretzel. But we actually did take all those road trips. I mean, like the actual road trip in the book, of course, it didn't play out quite the way it did in the book. But I think we must have logged 40, 50,000 miles. We did two or three trips across the West. We went all the way to Florida once. I took him to San Francisco, took him to Crater Lake. We had some great times. And he's an amazing, amazing kid. I call him a kid because I'm old.
So in the book, you had to get the permission of Trev's mother in order to take this kid, Trev, on the road. How'd that work in real life?
It took a while to earn her trust. I mean, you know, Rule's an amazing mom. I mean, she is, like in the book I say, she ought to wear a cape. I mean, she's done so much to compensate for his life's experience and so much to, I think it took a while for her to earn my trust. But once she earned her trust, you know, they're like family, you know, now. Mm-hmm. So after a couple of years, it wasn't hard to get permission to do just about anything I wanted with him.
Have you found yourself being invited to conferences and associations affiliated in some way with this disease or with those who suffer from it? Have you become an advocate of sorts, not just from your own experience, but I mean mainly from the book, because your own experience was just Jonathan Evason's. But when you put it in a book, all of a sudden you've really put this thing on the map.
Well, you know, caregiving is one thing. I've been the keynote speaker at the National Respite Care Convention a couple years back in Boston, and I've heard I've done a lot of work, you know, fundraising and things like that for the MDA, you know, Muscular Dystrophy Association, and I've met a lot of people in my travels. I mean, a lot of times at events and stuff, people with, you know, DMD will show up, or parents of people with DMD will show up, and I've been involved in a lot of dialogue, but I haven't actually done a convention. I played a Family Feud against librarians a couple years ago, and I just killed it. I was on fire. And I won a bunch of money for muscular dystrophy. That was a thrill.
Oh, that's great. So what about the training for caregiving? Where are we as a society? Where are we as individual states, if in fact this is something that's governed by states in regulation or whatever? Was your training sufficient for what you had to do?
I guess kind of the point of the book, the reason it's called The Revised Fundamentals of Caregiving, is this: I don't think there really is any training except the trenches. You know, a lot of it is, you know, learning how to avoid liability and insert catheters. A lot of you're basically taught so that you won't burn out to maintain a certain distance between the client. You know, it's not supposed to be personal, and this is where the disconnect is. It's just impossible for it not to become that way. Or if it is, I don't think you can really do a great job. I mean, on the level, you can do a good job. You can help somebody cut their toenails and you know, make sure they eat healthy and you know, get them in and out of the van and so forth. But, like, I mean, in order to sort of forge the sort of connection like Ben and Trev have in the book. I mean, it's impossible not to get personal, and they're never going to teach that in a class, I don't think. I mean, I think to a large part, I mean, what I learned in the caregiving community is the majority of people that I met that are caregivers usually started caregiving because they were caring for a relative or a friend. So they already had a personal relationship, and so these tend to be the most adept caregivers.
I'm Bob Kustra, host of Reader's Corner, and I'm talking with Jonathan Evason about his novel, The Revised Fundamentals of Caregiving. So I'm curious about the title of your book. I was bragging about your book as I was reading it, and I must say that I got different reactions. And one reaction that I got was, well, frankly, I don't think I really need to read about caregiving.
Yeah, and, you know, a lot of parents didn't want to read the book. Because, and the conversation about the book was really tough. You know, the word of mouth was very tough. I mean, the book did great, but it was a hard-won sales, I'll put it that way, because, you know, parents didn't want to read it, you know. I mean, you try to tell the book, it's really funny. It's about this dad that's accidentally responsible for the death of his own two kids. It's like, right there, just about every parent checks out. They can't read it. I don't know. Yeah. And the title, you know, I mean, Hollywood liked the title, but, like, you know, my publisher was not thrilled with it because it, you know, sounded to them like a care manual, which, you know, it was the only title the book could have for me. You know, it may not be the most commercial title, but the book just had to be called that. That's what the book is.
Well, the book is now going to become a movie. It's pretty impressive that Paul Rudd is going to play Benjamin.
Yeah, essentially because he's kind of me, and Paul Rudd's dreamy, you know. Everybody loves Paul Rudd. Women love him, men love him, dogs love him, kids love him. And the young man that plays Trev, Craig Roberts, is amazing, too. I got to spend a week on set in Atlanta back in February, and you know, they shoot films out of sequence, so it was hard. I saw some dailies, but it's really hard to get a feel for the whole narrative arc of the film based on a week shooting because you're all over the map. You're all over the script, basically, but... One thing I'm very confident about is that just the rapport between Paul and Craig is amazing, and I think it does justice to the relationship between Ben and Trev. You know, I kind of washed my hands of any propriety when I went into this, you know. The dictates for a 300-page novel and a 2-hour film are just so radically different that, you know, it's unreasonable to expect any film to do a book justice in a way. I think this one will capture the tone and the spirit, and I'm just going to go and enjoy it just as if I have nothing to do with it.
And you're going to be in it.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I have a big scene where I eat a cheeseburger from, like, you know, 100 feet. I didn't want any lines or anything like that. But when I was on set, I made sure to let everyone know this was my scene, even though it was a critical scene between Trev and Dot and their relationship. You know, the real focus of the scene here was me eating a cheeseburger in the booth behind them.
So let's focus on the protagonist here, Ben Benjamin, who's run across some very hard luck. And you referred to the fact, extremely difficult life, losing his two kids, and he apparently is responsible. But you talked earlier about how difficult it was for some parents to pick up this book when they learned what happened. But interestingly enough, and maybe I missed it, I never really got a complete explanation of what happened, the details of what happened, maybe even confirming his role in it. I mean, it's you allude to it a number of times, and his wife at the end, who's trying to seek a divorce from him, alludes to it. Was that intentional? Like, you know, the reader doesn't need to know anything else. You've alluded to it.
It was intentional, but I wasn't doing it to spare the reader the tragedy so much as that, in my experience, this is how we remember tragedy. You know, things that devastating happen, and shock sets in and almost immediately. Like, I think one of the truest things about the actual scene in the driveway, you know, what happens is he does or doesn't leave the car in gear. You know, that's the question. But the car either pops out of gear or he forgot to leave it in gear. And as he's, you know, the kids are behind the car as he's loading groceries, and he drops his groceries, and after the fact, after the car has rolled back over the kids and pushed them over the embankment, you know, he's in such shock at that point that the only thing that makes sense for him to do, the only part of the universe left for him to order that he has any control over is to get on his hands and knees and pick up the groceries. And this is the kind of behavior we see with events like this. I mean, I don't think very often these moments are remembered with so much a photographic fidelity.
Yeah, very well put. So let's talk about Ben from the standpoint of his goodness, because he's a loser in the sense that he's lost his two kids. Nothing's gone right for him. And I don't know whether you ever use that word loser, and maybe that's too tough.
Janet Maslin used the same word in the New York Times, and she said, "I had a way with losers." I don't look at them as losers,
yeah.
But you don't want it to be mawkish. So if you've got a you know, 30-something dad responsible for the death of his two kids, and then you've got a you know, a kid, mortally ill kid in a wheelchair, you could be shooting fish in a barrel, you know? I mean, so part of the challenge was to show these people how they really were, warts and all, right from the beginning. I mean, neither of these characters are very sympathetic at the beginning. They're both sort of like, they're both scared men. They're both masculine figures in crisis. So there's a lot of like sort of flippant misogyny that is just part of their repartee, just because they're who they are and they're scared. And, you know, I wanted to paint them right off the bat. And that's a lot of, you know, the rapport I had with Case is like, you know, we'd make a lot of rude jokes and you know, it's a dance. A dance two wounded people do. And I just didn't want them to be ignoble right off the bat. I wanted them to earn their nobility. I mean, just because you're in a wheelchair doesn't make you a noble person always. Mm-hmm. I met a guy once at a reading who had a neuromuscular disease, and he came up to me after the reading in his wheelchair, and he was like, "Wow, I really enjoyed your book. I wanted to give you my book of poems." And I was like, "Well, thank you, man." It seemed like a really heartfelt gesture, and I thought, "Wow, this is going to be deep. This is going to be about this guy struggling in a wheelchair." And I got on the plane and started reading it, and oh my God, it was just the most, like, it was just over the top, sexist, almost like pornographic poetry. It was shocking. Again, noted, just because somebody has got muscular dystrophy doesn't necessarily make them a great person.
So when I read Ben and what he does, let's just talk about the trip for a moment. These characters that he runs into, it's not like these characters are completely thrust upon him. Ben makes a conscious decision to pick up some of these folks along the roadside. And that's what I meant, I guess, earlier when I said that in spite of all of Ben's problems with his wife who wants a divorce and having to think back on the role he might have played in killing his own kids, this is a pretty decent guy.
You know, again, like Ben just had to earn his redemption. The reader gets to see that he is a good guy. He's a good guy that's flawed, like all of us. And you know, he's basically been a caregiver most of his adult life. He was a stay-at-home parent, and you know, that's why the kids died on his clock. And I'm glad that comes through. Some readers just don't get it. Some readers think he's a loser the whole way through, and they can't see that. But that tends to be the kind of character I relate to, the deeply flawed, marginalized character on the surface that really has a really big human streak in him.
It also tells me something about Jonathan Evason, though, because you didn't have to take Case all the way to Florida.
No, I didn't. I'll tell you the truth, though. Also, what it does is I loved doing that. I loved our relationship. I loved, you know, part of their relationship, too, is about Ben just pushing him, trying to push him past his limits because, you know, he's got his comfort zone. He doesn't like to push it. He likes to play things safe. And I know that I served that purpose in Trev's life. But also, you know, it can be so mind-numbingly dull to live under those constraints, you know, 40, 50 hours a week where you don't leave the living room and you're watching the Weather Channel and it's like, okay, it's 9/11. I'm going to put in the waffles. And, you know, not to sound selfish, but the road trips were actually great for me, too. You know, I mean, by taking us both out of that context, I mean, not only did our relationship blossom, not only we had new things to talk about, the hours were, you know, it just almost felt like a prison at times. Anybody who's been a caregiver can relate. You know, a person, you spend 50 hours a week with a person caring for their every need, and people don't want to say it, but they'll drive you crazy. You know what I mean? You want to strangle them after a while. This is what they try to guard against with the burnout. This is why it's not supposed to get personal, because once you start taking it personally, it can be quite suffocating. So the road trips were a beautiful antidote to that.
You're listening to Reader's Corner. I'm Bob Kustra, and our guest today is novelist Jonathan Evason, author of The Revised Fundamentals of Caregiving. Well, the road trips are a great travelogue, and you've covered some really interesting places across the West, and you alluded earlier to the fact that since this is down in Atlanta, we're probably, I assume we're not going to be seeing George Washington, and I mean the town of George, than right. the state
well,
of Washington.
You know, there's little towns in Georgia as well that will suit it well. I know we did we shot a couple of days in a little town called Cartersville, which is, you know, in every town in America as well. The thing about the road trip is, you know, of course Hollywood was going to embrace that, but I really did not want to write a road novel. I was very resistant to the idea. It's just been done to death. I mean, you know, Homer wrote a pretty good one. Mark Twain wrote a pretty good one on the river. You know, Kerouac wrote a good one. I did everything I could, and you can feel it in the first 100 pages of the book. I'm trying to subvert that inevitable road trip. But ultimately, these characters were just driving around in circles, and the only thing that could deliver them was the road. So my characters really just dragged me kicking and screaming to the road.
So the flashbacks, or whatever you would call them, you're the technical writer, I'm not, but throughout the book, you're taking the reader back to your relationship to your two children and your wife. Explain the role that plays in this novel.
Well, I'm always trying to frustrate the linearity of narratives. You'll see that a lot when I send you Harriet Chance, which the narrative just pinballs through time. I mean, sometimes 60 years in a page. Part of that was frustrating the linearity of the novel, and part of it was that, you know, when you've suffered some sort of tragedy like this, you live in that tragedy. You're still there. And in fact, it's, you know, I think all the flashback of that last day of his life, you know, I just keep going back to that last day of the kid's life, and it's just a routine day. Wake up, all the rank and file disorder at the breakfast table and taking the kids to the aquatic museum and just all the stuff a single parent does. But it's just revisited in painfully, you know, accurate detail. And because, you know, unlike the actual event itself, which, as we discussed earlier, which can be obscured by just the heft and weight of the event itself, these little details of his life are very, are reported with a real photographic fidelity. And they're also put there in the present tense. And that's because Ben is still living there. He's still in that day. He, you know, psychologically, that day will never end for him. So, served a couple of purposes.
You know, when I finished reading this book, one of the thoughts I had is that I don't think I can ever look again at a parent or parents wheeling a child in a wheelchair that has some affliction, some disease, like the one of Duchenne's muscular dystrophy, in the same way. Thanks to the work that you've done in this book. And you've done it both in a positive sense by the role that Ben plays in Trev's life, but also in a negative sense of how tough it can be, because in a sense, the travel in this book has a goal in mind, and that's to find Trev's father. Tell us a little bit about this guy, and really, I don't know whether or not he is the great exception to the rule in situations like this, because he's probably not the only guy that did what he did, walk away.
No, in fact, you know, I mean, one thing I learned as a caregiver, you know, I had multiple clients over the years, but there was definitely a pattern of men flying the coop early on. A lot of my clients were children of single mothers. Bob is based on Case's real dad. Thank God he actually liked the book. I think that I actually ennobled Bob, as hard as it seems. I think I ennobled him more than maybe some would argue he even deserved. Because one of my goals is to take characters who are not very sympathetic and very flawed and make them sympathetic. I mean, I think that's one of the most powerful things fiction can do, is offer you this empathic window to really walk a mile in somebody else's shoes. And I find it satisfying to take a character that's really hard to like and make you relate to them. That's what Bob was for me. I mean, I you know, you could say I let him off the hook a little bit, but I think I made him earn it.
Oh, I don't think there's any question about that. But again, I can't emphasize enough that it does show the challenges of raising a child with a severe disease like this. You're a remarkably versatile individual in the sense that before you got into the writing business, or maybe it was at the same time you were in the writing business, you were also in the music business. Tell us about your musical past.
Well, you know, music is a stretch. I was in punk bands in the early 80s, and, you know, Mostly we're kind of a footnote in the history of grunge because other members of the band went on to Pearl Jam and Soundgarden, and I grew up with all the guys from Mudhoney and the Melvins and things like that. Personally, I never really had much musical talent, whereas my bandmates really did. They were a pretty amazing punk rock band for the time. I mean, when I listened to it, I listened to them, and you know, we actually have an album coming out this year of stuff that was recorded 32 years ago, which is pretty funny. I was in music. I was in radio. I had a career in radio for a while. I've written 5 or 6 screenplays on contract, something I don't want to do again. A lot of it is just trying to, it's so hard to make a living writing books, and I'm finally at a place where I'm doing well at that. But, you know, there was 10, 12 years there where I was just trying to do, in my 30s, trying to do anything I can that utilized those talents I had, you know. But when I finally got a break and somebody wanted to publish Lulu, and it did well, it was like I finally at last could focus on the one thing I really wanted to do.
And that book is entitled All About Lulu, right?
Yeah.
So those 5 screenplays, did they make it to the screen?
Nope, none of them. None of them ever produced, which, you know, that's the rule, not the exception. But, you know, I got paid. And, you know, honestly, they probably weren't very good. I don't even remember. I've written a lot of bad stuff in my day. I wrote, you know, 8 books before All About Lulu was published. And 4 of those, I literally had to dig a hole and bury and salt the earth because they were not good.
Well, you're certainly writing the good stuff now, and you're going to have a release on September 8th. This Is Your Life, Harriet Chance?
Yes.
Tell us about that book. It sounds like a really interesting treatment, and again, a treatment of folks we just don't get close enough to.
You hit it when you said I tend to choose marginalized characters, and there's few groups more marginalized in our society than an 80-year-old woman. So it was kind of a tribute to the women of the greatest generation. My first experience in caregiving was living with my grandmother the last 2 years of her life. She was agoraphobic, and so I was essentially her caregiver when I was about 17 and 18 years old. I lived with her, I did her shopping, cooked for her, etc., kept her company. But like that experience, here I was like 17, 18 years old, just sort of getting out on my own theoretically, and I was surrounded by elderly people, and actually was quite comfortable with it.
Well, Jonathan, I have to say, I've said it before, but I close a lot of programs just simply giving our listeners the name of the book and the author. But I really do have to add in this case that this is a book I didn't want to finish. This is a book that I wanted to just keep reading. It's a book about goodness, the goodness of the human soul, and people who, unfortunately, we just don't spend enough time thinking about. And you've done a remarkable job here of helping us get inside some remarkable people. And even though the ones in your book aren't for real, they really are for real all over the place. All we have to do is walk outside and they'll be there. And maybe we'll have a little bit more respect for them after reading your book. And that, to me, is an awfully powerful tale. As an author,
I
to tell.
I get tired of hearing that, my friend.
Yeah, right. Well,
it can be a pretty lonely exercise in humiliation writing books. But when I can get through, when I can reach the reader like that, when I can get them to come through that empathic window with me, you know, I feel like I've done my job, and that makes me proud. So
yeah.
I appreciate that.
Well, you should be proud, and you have done your job. The name of the book, The Revised Fundamentals of Caregiving. The author is Jonathan Evason. Jonathan, thank you so much for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me. It was kind of early in the morning. I may not have been my sharpest.
I thought you were great. I hope you enjoyed this encore edition of our interview with Jonathan Evason. And a reminder to our listeners that Jonathan will be visiting Boise as a featured presenter at the literary festival Storyfort, which this year runs March 23rd through March 26th. You can find out more about Storyfort and other events that are part of the annual Treefort Music Fest on the web at treefortmusicfest.com. Next week, Sean Vestal, author of a debut novel, Daredevils. Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research by Sherry Squires. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner. We invite you to sign up for our free email podcast on our website. That's BoiseStatePublicRadio.org. While you're there, you can check out what's coming up next on Reader's Corner and listen to previous interviews online. You can also access recent interviews on our free app
for mobile devices. Download it from Google Play or the App Store.